So, and these are just some of our other collaborators that we have on this project. The end goal of DARPA is to see something useful come out of this, something of practical interest. So we're sort of driving ourselves to think of applications, and I don't have much progress to report there. Maybe some of the others will, but that's sort of the, there's twofold. One is to obviously think of things that would be products or some things with enhanced properties. Our other mission was to characterize and really prove that we had what we said we had. So, this is animated, doesn't need to be. These are my topics. Negative refraction, a couple of statements about negative refraction, what our material characterization is like. The experiments on negative refraction, if I get there, the perfect lens calculations, and how modulated beams interact with negative index materials. So the first thing is, I won't go over everything that Vesalago said, but when you're talking about materials with negative epsilon and mu, the only constraint is set by causality or requirement that you have positive energy. And that leads to these relations, which really aren't all that restrictive. So the relative permittivity and permeability and the index all need to go to 1 as omega goes to infinity. And away from there, you have certain dispersive properties that have to be satisfied. But they're pretty gentle in reality, not like the structures we've seen. And this point was made just at the peers meeting last week. So large bandwidth is not excluded by these relations, and they don't imply excessive losses. So I just wanted to state that up front. There's been some talk about what you name these materials, and I've liked negative refractive. Rick likes double negative. Are you still going with that? And there's been a backward wave by a group in Finland. I like negative refractive because you can come up with a rigorous argument. Pendry gave you one based on the fact that epsilon and mu are analytic. Whenever we do a problem where we're going to involve time dependence, we have to take into account the dispersive characteristics of the medium. And so the refractive index is going to be expressed as a square root of some thing with zeros and poles. And in between those zeros and poles, you have to choose a sign for that. I'm assuming, just for simplicity, that this is lossless. So this is a reasonable form for epsilon, a reasonable form for mu. You put them together and take the square root. You have this, but you have to choose a sign, plus or minus. So in typical things, some of the problems we've been doing, you're going to integrate over frequency to find a time dependence, or either in Laplace or a Fourier method, and you'll have something like a contour which goes along. I won't go through the details of the problem that this was specific to, but as you go through, you find there's regions where the real part of the index is going to be greater than zero. This is set by the boundary condition, and once you set that boundary condition, the rest follows. In the intervening regions, at least for this function, you have evanescent modes, and right around here, where you have, where you're in between a pole and a zero, you have to have a negative real part of the index. So if you go by analytic arguments, negative index is a reasonable concept. And so I tend to now want to stick, instead of left-handed or any of the other names, negative index materials, or NIM. So how did we get there, and what are the building blocks we use? So you don't find it in any. They don't affect the real parts.
Another way, how are these poles and zeros lifted off?
They go down. In this case, this is a Fourier. We've also done, I'll talk about later, Laplace, and then it's a little different, but you always move to one side, and you want to satisfy causality by integrating, closing in one of the half planes. Right. That is, yeah, these are for nearly transparent media.
So group velocity is always less than C?
The group velocity is always, yeah, less than C. Right. And this doesn't cover the case of the region of anomalous dispersion, which I think you're going to talk about on Thursday now. This comes from causality. Kramer's chronic basically comes up with this.
But it also makes true again.
Yeah.
Well, if Grandma gets a more general argument, right, where we've got two in
the I think you right. I think this is a stronger one. There's two, and this is the stronger. Well, he's got one where he says that this there's an inequality where this is greater than zero, and then there's a stronger one which says it's greater than one, and that's the one that I. Yeah, that's a good point, because Rick had that question too. We went to this because we wanted a function that would go to one as the frequency goes to infinity.
Yeah.
If you look at what better approximates the function in the frequency range where we're using it, it's John's formula, and that's what Rick's found also, I think. Right, it was just to have a reasonable causal form, so that we were doing a calculation where we wanted to have integrate to infinity, omega goes to infinity. No.
Yeah, also, why did you put a complex term in the
Just no particular reason. Yeah, that was just a choice for what, I mean, we were using, it goes in with the next slide. We're using these wires. At least at the time we were using wires which approximate this. There is some damping in here, but it has a dispersion somewhat like this. And the rings we were using definitely were resonant, so we couldn't. So I just transferred that over when we did that work. So these are the elements that we combined to make a negative index metamaterial. We did it with these because we don't know of any material you can just grab naturally occurring or a compound that has that property. But we were playing around with these wires that Pendry had published in 1996, and then the rings that we came across at the conference in Laguna Beach in 1999. And they have these sort of generic dispersion curves. And there's a region here which is supposed to have negative permeability, and a region here which should have negative permittivity. And if you move this up and have these overlap, you'd have a region where both epsilon and mu would be negative. Okay, so without going through the details of Vessel-Lago and some of the things that Pendry went through yesterday, we're at the point where how do we know that we have what we think we have? And so when we first heard about the rings, what you'd like to do is throw them in some apparatus and do a standard engineering S-parameters test. So you take your material of some length d, you come in with an incoming wave, you measure the reflected amplitude and phase, and you measure the transmitted amplitude and phase. So there's four parameters there, and then you can work backwards to get your four material parameters, either index and impedance or epsilon and mu, real and imaginary parts. The trouble is that's a complicated measurement, and it's even more complicated by the fact that you have metamaterial here whose x equals zero isn't very well defined. You have to make a decision as to where your front surface starts, and Rick and I have swapped horror stories about going through and doing this, because we have done that since, but we didn't. At the time, it looked like something that would be much too burdensome to do. So you can invert these equations, and I've worked with some. We've done this now by simulation, and I've worked with Iowa State, Peter Marcos, and Costas Sakoulis, who run the transfer matrix program. And so we can get the data, and at least in principle, we can do it. So you can invert these equations, and they look mild enough. This is the reflection and the transmission coefficient for a slab. You can invert them, and so you only have to deal with an ambiguity in sign for the impedance, and that's not too hard to get around. But the index has lots of branches. It's a well-known problem, an infinite number of branches, and if you're not careful, you can end up jumping all over the place. T prime, I've just put a phase factor into T. I've brought this over here and called that T prime. So this more corresponds to the S parameters rather than the transmission reflection. So here's an example for wires. This is by simulation. We had some transfer matrix data, which I haven't shown here. We expected to have this form, and this is what we get by inverting the S scattering parameters. So I don't have the what you might expect for the theoretical curve because it lies right on top of this. And this is for 1, 3, and 5 rows. And by the time you're beyond one row, it converges to, I mean, the wires behave very nicely. So this is just some one unit cell you're transferring through, applying periodic boundary conditions and looking to see what gets transmitted. 1, 3, 5, 10, up to 15 rows we did. And you get pretty much the same answer. For the wire? In this case, it was a fairly lossy metal. A fairly lossy metal. It wasn't a perfect metal. Oh, yeah, you could make something like this. Huh? The material parameters of the scatter were like a metal. Just like a wire, but this region here gives you a effective plasma frequency or effective cutoff frequency around 20 gigahertz. That's not like a material you could have, but it's a metamaterial that you can have. No. What we were using, but in the calculation, this is earlier data. They weren't able to put in such large. They didn't have the right things to mimic copper. So, all right, so we can do the wires, and we've now set up a little chamber to do some measurements to characterize these things. So you might ask, if you do the experiment, do you see the same sort of thing? And this is a composite material made by putting together a couple laminates of some fiberglass material, in which are a bunch of wires. And I don't know the exact dimensions and details of the wires for this sample. But again, you can go through and put in, here's a little sample area here, several layers of this stuff from one to many. And here's a horn here, there's a horn on the other side, and you can measure the transmitted amplitude and phase. This is what you see. Up here, there's obviously some turn on. There's attenuation below. And you go up here because our chamber isn't designed really to go down to 2 gigahertz. This is a frequency scale here. So you have attenuation, and then you have transmission above that. And if you invert and work backwards from the measured amplitude and phase for the transmission coefficient, you can find the dielectric constant. And the simulation curve here is this red one. And the various data sweeps, different numbers of layers, lie on top of that. So this includes the dielectric constant of the composite, which is somewhere around 4 or 5, which is why this is going up to 4 instead of around up to 1. And here's a plasma frequency, which is, in this case, was pretty low, was like 4.5 gigahertz. So we can do the measurement, we can do the calculation for the wires, and now the split ring resonators. When John published his paper, he had an analytic form to predict what omega naught was and F was and the various parameters that enter this. But what really, we just took it and said, okay, this has a generic form. Let's first run a simulation and see what we get. And I think the analytic is fairly off, maybe a factor of 2 from what we find for the split rings anyway, by simulation and by measurement. Have you gone back and corrected
that?
A lot of other people are working on that. Going into the details. So there's some capacitance here, and some it's messy. So this is a finite difference simulation, frequency domain. and you recover the generic dispersion curve that you'd expect. Right, this is phase advance right here along this direction, or K, and this is frequency, so everywhere you have a mode, and then you have a gap here, and it fits this curve quite well. We can make these things up. This is shown with the wires, the first structure that we made. But the first thing we did was just to measure these rings.
And
this is not a fit at all. This is just showing, these circles show where we did the calculations and the lines were fit through the curves. But this is, we took a perfectly conducting split ring resonator onto some dielectric that was similar to the circuit board material, and just ran the simulation, and that's what came out of it. So this is just a simulation. And it shows something should occur right around 4 and a half gigahertz. That's where the band should be. We can also, that's a dispersion type, curve type calculation. Again, we've worked with the data from Iowa State, Kostas Sikoulis' group. And if we do the calculation for this sort of ring, this happens to be square, but the details are the same, you get a permeability that looks like that. It's negative over some region. This is a different parameter, so it's a different frequency, but the generic properties are the same. It has some absorption because, again, these were lossy. And we also have an epsilon response, or a permittivity response due to the rings, and that is fairly sizable and has to be taken into account and caused us a lot of troubles when we were trying to understand what we actually had. there's also another method of finding these things that I'm not going to talk about here, but when John published his paper on the split rings, he included an analytical effective medium theory based on averaging fields over a cell. So we do that now all the time, and it agrees perfectly with what we find this way. And it's strange, I'm just going to go ahead because this is the right audience to point out this little problem here. And it's interesting. Here there's a resonance curve for the permeability, and it goes negative here, so everything's fine with that. That matches what the prediction was. If you look here, you see this goes down and then up and then goes through. So there's like a little resonance here, but it's got the wrong direction. It's going down and then up. And what I haven't shown you is the imaginary part, because I didn't want to get into trouble in a lot of cases. The imaginary part actually goes negative, and I'm choosing even minus I omega t. So here we have, this is the correct, what you'd expect to happen. Here, if I were to have plotted the imaginary part, it would go negative, so it's got the wrong sign. Positive. Yeah, positive. John's found the same behavior, and there's a lot of issues with this. It's bianisotropic, people have now found, it does, and we should talk about that because that's one of the interesting things about this. They're related, so if you look at the index is definitely, the imaginary part is definitely greater than zero everywhere. So there's no problem, there's no real gain in this. But epsilon and mu are coming from this effective medium, effective retrieval process, and they're somehow connected. They're not independent. But it is interesting that you recover that, and something that I think would be worth discussing more.
How negative does it get?
Well, you're seeing something here that's on the order of two. I'd say the imaginary part probably, in this case, would go to minus one for the imaginary part. Actually, I'm not sure that's the same scale. The permittivity, the real part is positive, but the imaginary part, yeah, it gets pretty large. I don't know offhand. I'm not sure this is the right scale, actually, for the imaginary part. But it's substantial. If on a relative scale, if this is this big, then that would be about half this, and negative.
I've seen similar things, but I've always counted everything.
I think it's working right, and I think I have an argument to say why it has to be, but it's just an argument, and it'd be nice to put that on a better. Yes, he said that. He was braver than I was. Yep. it's uniquely negative index, but the as you go toward what is a band edge, you can't avoid the fact that you're seeing a periodic structure. So over some range, the effective medium works if we look at the dispersion curve. Yes.
So I guess the either question, you know, is this an artifact?
Down here they are.
You're always going to those gaps if the areas of the put on the surface, for example, mesh across the grid.
Right.
And that's a dielectric.
Well, yeah, but the wavelength in the material as you go to the band edge right here starts to get on the order of the structure. So I'd expect there to be problems here where we see the problems. But down here, the wavelength of the material is much larger than the spacing. So, well, actually, I find it throughout the entire... I find it throughout the range, I mean, where the imaginary part of the of epsilon goes negative is sort of throughout that frequency range. When I'm done, maybe I'll just give you my argument as to why that has to happen. This is the experimental apparatus that we've been using for a long time. Shelley sort of came up with this to reduce the costs of doing these experiments, confine things in two dimensions. Electric boundary conditions are equivalent to periodic if you have a symmetric structure in between. So here, as an example, I've put in the rings so that they're symmetric between the plates. Sometimes we're not exactly symmetric, but we're not too far from symmetric, so it's okay. Here's the top view. You see that there's absorber on the sides. We can bring in microwaves this way. We can detect them here. Or we can also put the lid on this thing, which has a lot of holes, and we can bring antennas through and excite whatever structure. We're coming in to a waveguide, which confines the electric field to be uniform this way. Right. Instead of having a structure periodic and having to pay money to make a structure like this, we can confine it in this. That's what it buys us. So here's an example of a transmission measurement and the interpretation. This is on the rings structure. Is that you have positive permeability here, and negative permeability here, and you see the gap or the attenuation region. I don't have the scale here, but this is 10 dB per division, and this is the noise floor of our machine, so that's a fairly substantial gap, and that was over about probably a dozen rows of split rings. Okay, so the idea is if we combine a wire structure which has a plasma frequency well above where these rings have their band, that combination should give a negative refractive index material if these are really giving a negative permeability. So we can go through, and again, we can start and do the calculation. This is now for something that looks like this. And rather than these lines, which we've got for the rings alone, if we add the wires, we now get this line here, this dashed line. And it has a characteristic that you'd be expecting. It's got a negative group velocity, or at least that the phase and group velocities are in different directions, anti-parallel. Sure. Yeah, it's standard, I think, in band structure theory to call these negative group velocity bands, right? Because you're folding them back into, but it doesn't have a negative group velocity. Group velocity is positive. Sure. You'd want to flip it back onto this side, right?
Or if you shift it to this one, you have to just invert it to make sure that the transfer from the band up to the limit to stay positive.
Right. But we were following... But that's a standard thing in band structure, that everything gets folded back, and you talk about, I mean, even in Veselago's paper, I think he was using that convention. Okay, so again, you can play with the S-matrix inversion for calculated data, simulated data. This again is square rings and square posts, but the same idea holds. And you get, after you do the inversion, you get, this shows that you have this region of negative index. And Boeing has much better data on this. This is, again, some initial data that we had. But it shows, you know, if you want to say, this process is unambiguous. So you get this region of negative index. If you want to say, well, that's not, you've made a sign error, then this part over here is negative index. But that doesn't really make sense. So this is all reasonable and consistent. So going through the measurement that we did, this is for our original PRL. If we put in wires alone, we get basically the noise floor of our sweeper. And the interpretation is that that's for negative epsilon. As I showed you, if you put in rings alone, you get this gap here where mu is, should be less than zero. And if you add rings, the rings plus the wires, then you get this red curve here, which John showed yesterday, which is consistent with mu being greater than zero, epsilon less than zero out here. So you have attenuation. And here, mu and epsilon are both less than zero, so you have propagation. And mu greater than zero, epsilon less than zero here, so you have attenuation again. Now, this was our initial set of data, and it just worked out. We were exciting with antennas. The chamber wasn't made for 5 gigahertz where these things were resonant. And there was a lot of suspicion because this passband sort of comes where you see the, if the rings alone, they go down to a certain level. So people started advancing all sorts of other hypotheses for why this behavior was happening. And we had to look for another method of characterizing it, or an additional method. So the main prediction, if we really have negative epsilon and negative mu, is that instead of having right-handed refraction, if we come in with waves at an angle, we should have left-handed refraction. And this, because the, if you have your incident wave vector, the parallel component is conserved, but the normal component of K is reversed, so you have to draw the wave coming backwards, and you end up with a diagram that has to be drawn like this, and that implies negative refraction. Sure. Measurements, that was all theoretical. That was from simulation data. This?
First,
2D waveguide. Yeah, so it was a structure. And right. Or a plane wave. So we come in with a in this, yeah, right. Ideally, we'd come in with a horn and then have it expand through the absorber so that we're exciting the thing with a plane wave coming in. So E is like this and H is like that. We were exciting with antennas, so this is less than ideal, for sure. Oh, but there's only one excited at that frequency. We're below.
No, I don't believe.
It's true that, yeah.
You know what I mean.
If you have an obstacle or a perturbation, you're going to excite all the modes.
You don't have only the transverse 1-0 mode in your cavity, in your waveguide. It's such a load.
With such a load, but if you go downstream, there's only one that propagates
to
through.
Calculate, to determine from the transmission and from the.
No. If you excite it,
yeah.
Or if you come in with a tapered, with the waveguide injecting,
I have seen yeah.
You're only going to excite one mode. If you put an obstacle there, you'll convert to many other modes. That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
But all those have evanescent character, right? At the frequency you're operating, which is well below. It's in the cutoff region for any of those other modes. So if you're downstream enough, you're not going to see those. And you can question how far downstream enough is.
Yeah.
but I think we're far enough away from the scattering region that's...
No, I don't agree. Is that a note? Well, not a valid fine.
We should discuss that. Yeah, okay.
We can discuss it later.
Yeah.
But a related question, if you measure the, whether you have a unit phase output, and you get that length phase?
I'm sure we didn't. This was done with antenna coupling. I'm sure we didn't. I mean, I'm sure it was very poor. There was no question on that experiment. Yeah.
Excuse me. You determine the properties of the black box, but not of the material.
The
black box means the geometry of your waveguide, including the load.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
And the question is how, to what extent that will approximate what the material does. Now, since then, we've been working with Boeing, which has repeated that. I didn't have my statement up here, but everything we've done has been found to be consistent. So Boeing is now doing free space measurements, and they're doing the same sort of processes, and they get the same results we got. So it turns out, whatever you want to say, and which I'd agree with, it seems to continue to hold even when we're doing these, doing things more methodically now, which is a surprise, I think, something of a surprise. So to do the Snell's Law experiment, we went to a 2D, roughly 2D isotropic structure. And in this case, we got rid of the standing posts and just put them lithographically on the back of the circuit boards and put this thing together. Rick Shelby did this work. I didn't think it would work. But I told him, go ahead, try it. And he tried it, and it worked.
How can you make this structure
practically? Practically. Oh, how tall can we do it?
Yes.
Well, the circuit board comes, you know, in sheets, you know, that big.
And,
yeah, Boeing, you saw Boeing. Right. Yeah, Boeing's done this. Yeah. This is 1 centimeter. Let's see. Is that, yeah, 1 centimeter tall. And so these rings are spaced about 3.3 millimeters. And this structure is set to operate around X band, as you see here. So this is just transmission through the thing. There's a subtlety associated with this structure, which I'll mention caused us a lot of heartache for a while. You're seeing propagation along two different, say, 1001 axes. And there's a little bit of an offset. And if you looked at how it was put together, there was a bit of a shift that was consistent throughout the structure. So we think that explains that. And this is along the 1-1 direction, for example. And so there's some degree of isotropy in this structure. When we first looked at, this is a transmission curve, and this is the rings alone. It was a little bit strange that this transmission was sort of offset from where the gap was. But if this material is really going to behave, or you expect it to behave like a continuous material, and you expect that these simple frequency-dependent formulas should describe this, if you look at a SLAD calculation transmission, you should recover something like that. And this isn't the best example I've shown, but this really did sort of manifest itself, that we saw this shift for under some parameters. And it just has to do with the impedance match being taken into account. I should mention here that you see this lower band because the wires, unlike the last experiment, didn't make electrical contact between the top and bottom plates. And if you don't make that contact, then you bring up a resonance just like you do in the mu. And so both forms look the same. Both have a resonant frequency as well as a plasma frequency. So you're seeing that there, and this is the band that we work with. And this is a depiction of the refraction experiment we did, which included launching a wave down here somewhere, guiding it between absorber, so that we come in something like a fairly well-defined aperture here, and then putting a prism sample and measuring the transmitted radiation around the periphery of the structure as a function of angle. And I was just talking last week to one of our program officers who complained that every time I put this up, I make it sound too easy. So it was a hard experiment. It's harder than it looks because it took a while for people to end up demonstrating this, and it, in fact, just now people are starting to demonstrate it again. Kong's group at MIT reported their results, and I think a few others have done it now. Right, to the extent that this aperture allows that. So the aperture is an important. So I should stop here because there's. I just got an email this morning that's from one of these reporters, Physics World. John and I both got it. That they want to do yet another story on the controversy. So there's been some people taking a look at this and looking for other alternate explanations. So this is one point that I should mention. The idea is that, as it's shown here, this is positive refraction. So if this were a sample of Teflon, which I'll show in a second, you'd expect that the radiation go this way. If we have our negative refractive sample, then we expect the radiation should go this way. And that's what we see, as I'll show in the next couple slides. One alternative hypothesis is that you have a very, very lossy material here. It's not negative refractive, but it's just really lossy. And if it's really lossy, one might argue that you preferentially allow radiation to get through here. And so maybe you'd expect to detect an increased amount of radiation here. To me, that just sort of says that you've set a new aperture. But in the far field, you shouldn't expect to see that. I mean, if you have a positive refracting sample, if you look far enough away, it's not going to be positive. So where that, I mean, it's not going to be negative. Where that occurs is in the very near fields of the waves coming out, and we were about 5 wavelengths away. So I don't think that's a very valid argument. Since then, Boeing, is it far enough? So it's set by the Fresnel zone. I mean, actually, I'd say that's set by the evanescent. And at these frequencies, one wavelength, I would think, would be enough to discount that. There's another question if you're in the... Well, the Fresnel length is set by the aperture, so it's d squared over 2 lambda or something like that. So we were roughly about that range, not quite far enough out of it. But even still, we're far from the evanescent. I mean, you'd have to argue that we were seeing something that was 5 wavelengths down in attenuation, which isn't very likely. Rayleigh meaning? Okay, so I'd call it Fresnel. Yeah. All right. So I'd call that, so for me that's the near zone and the far zone. And near field and far field that to me means evanescent, in the evanescent range or propagating. That is an issue of semantics that's causing confusion, I think. Boeing has since looked at this at 10 and 15 wavelengths away in their negative refraction experiment. So it's hard to argue the evanescent, and they're also fairly well out of the Fresnel in the far zone. Right. Right. For this experiment? Well, I can work backwards because it turns out that if you were to calculate the Fresnel length, we were, let's see, 13, 15. Oh, we were not 40. We were. This is about 6 inches. This is 6 inches, and that turns out if you work backwards, the wavelength where we worked out was 10 gigahertz. So if you work out lambda squared over 2d, right? Yeah.
How did you produce a microwave beam? Is it in a pipe?
Out here there's a coupler, N-type to waveguide coupler. And this is
a waveguide?
Right. This is, if you look this way, it's waveguide height. It's 1 centimeter high. And so we have a coupler in the back and couples
you know
in.
That you have at the end of the waveguide a completely undefined spread of your beam?
Well, it's guided.
I'm surprised how you can measure the effect.
The question is, how well is the beam defined here, right?
Yeah, is it undersized or oversized, or what is it? The waveguide.
This is two parallel plates,
yeah,
a centimeter apart, and a channel created by absorber.
Yeah.
And the channel length was, I think, about 6 centimeters, 5 or 6 centimeters. And it was tapered in the back. It came to a taper where you had a waveguide coupler, N-type to waveguide. So coming in from the 0.9 inches out, expanding out to create a beam. And we did some plots to see that we were fairly uniform across here. You're looking at a top view. Let's see if I have a better picture here. This is a top view. And so there's plates on top and bottom of this thing. Yeah. And down here somewhere is the coupler. I should show a picture of that. So coming back to the details. The mode structure, we didn't carefully characterize it. We just did some plots and saw that it was fairly uniform across here. And of course, it tends to go to zero near the absorber. But it could be better characterized. And blowing since has just gone to free space where you don't have the issues associated with this experiment. So for Teflon, you have some reassurance because here's Teflon. Here's the experiment. At the peak of this, you look at the angle you get, work it backwards, and you find that an index of 1.4. You do that as a function of frequency, and it's static, as you expect Teflon to be. So that gives you a good feeling. And then here's our sample, and this is an actual picture of what we're using. It was not done like this. The waveguide didn't come up like that. So this is a really misleading picture. And the sample we used was cut and at a shallower angle. So at some frequency, we have a transmitted band. This is normalized power. It was definitely lossier, or apparently lossier. I can't factor into account the mismatch as well. We haven't done that. But the peak that we got was, if you work back from the angle, is minus 2.7.
Normalized to each other?
Just normalized to each other. Normalized to one. They're set to peak at one. Yeah. It was very much lower, yeah. It was about 20 dB down in the sample. And we can continue and look as a function of frequency, which we did. Sure. No, we didn't. As I said, this was before any funding. And I don't have the data. We've now been working with Boeing, so they have all the data of the recent stuff. And they really did a beautiful job at the peers meeting showing, I wish I had brought. Yeah, maybe I can download it and show it to you afterwards, because it's just incredible how it all agrees. But I don't have it, so you just have to take my word for it. It's all great. Anyway, going back to our poor data, it still wasn't that bad. If you looked at some reasonable parameters for the material and did a fit, you'd expect, this was from one of our papers, and this is sort of a general behavior of the index, how it should be dispersive. And if you look at what we found, the black curve hidden under all the curve fitting is the region of negative index. And you see it tails off right here. And if you calculate what you'd expect for the angle of TIR, it actually occurs right there. So this all was consistent. A lot of things done wrong, as you're pointing out, a lot of things not well characterized, but there is sort of a body of consistency there that made us feel comfortable enough to go forward with this. And it's borne out in subsequent work. So that tops off the experiments, and then the conclusion is that the data is consistent with negative index, and we believe that index smaller than zero is meaningful. And of course, this is DARPA's question: what use can you find for these things? So what's my timing? Plenty of time. Okay, so I'll just plunge forward now to some of the stuff we've done on the perfect lens, which a lot of this was first stimulated because we wanted to do the experiment on the perfect lens, and we thought maybe we could throw our material together and just do it. Sure. So Boeing has put together, I mean, they're working on three aspects. One, they're charged with reproducing everything that we did and to the satisfaction of DARPA. Two, they're pursuing different methods of fabrication, and they've done a nice job of making something that really looks like a material that's made from rings and Rexolite, and it's all glued together, so it's a solid chunk. And then they're also charged with finding an application. So in terms of the experiments, they've now we're working with them to try and characterize planar samples in the method that Rick's done and we've done in free space measurements. And then they've also put together a prism sample like we have and done the negative refraction experiment at this point. Right, so they've done, they've gone much further. They've measured a sample that was set to work at X-band. And again, I don't know what the diameter of their beam was because they're now in free space, but they come in, they've done it focused and also collimated. And they've gone from, I just know the numbers, they've measured at 6, 10, 26 inches away from the thing. And for them, I'm pretty sure that corresponds to several times the Fresnel length in the farthest.
And what is the
right. Well, so the losses we think, we're pretty sure now, are coming from the circuit board material. And so we used a cheap circuit board and Rexlite. Yeah, they haven't measured the Rexlite samples. They've measured the FR4. They have not measured the Rexlite. So I think their losses are better than ours, but there's some variation. FR4 isn't meant to work at 10 gigahertz. It's not sold for that. And so from different suppliers, you see different results. In fact, we had a commercial. This nice structure was made by our graduate student just on his own. We sent some out just recently, and they came back. They were much better. Tolerance was much better, and they looked beautiful. Put them in, and it acted much worse. And when we looked at the circuit board, you could just see that it was a poor sort of circuit board. So there's a circuit board called Rogers. Is that what you're using now?
Rogers is the company. Duroid,
yeah. There's several, versions of that. They're much, much better. They're at least a factor of 10 better than FR4. Okay. And Rexlite is better, so. A lot of the poor results that you see here are due to that.
So what can you expect for the transition?
There's no, if you could have the conductors just sitting in air or on something ideally lossless, the losses aren't that noticeable. I mean, you could get a transmission peak of one nearly. So I don't think there's any inherent loss issue, except you got to use the right circuit board.
Yeah. I can corroborate.
Yeah. It's pretty much garbage for what we're doing. We wanted to do this, look at this sub-wavelength focusing, and we just wanted to throw one of our available materials in. And so that's what sort of prompted this work. There's two things that prompted it. The other one was Marshall Rosenbluth, who found something paradoxical in this, and I'll get to where that took us. But just from the first instance, you know, can our samples give us sub-wavelength focusing? And so this is a problem that we saw. We look at this gets us the reflection and transmission coefficients for a slab, and then we're going to take a source distribution and expand it in all transmission reflection in that basis, and look at the effect of a negative index material here. That's sort of the standard thing. So when we want to get sub-wavelength focusing, what's actually happening in here, and John showed yesterday that your evanescent components, which are going to contribute to that sub-wavelength focus, which decay out here, are turned around and grow inside the material so that they're larger on this face, and then they are going to decay again. So this example, just to put it in perspective, this is for a Kx of 1.1, which is your Kx is roughly a measure of how sub-wavelength you are. So this isn't very sub-wavelength, and already you're needing a field here that's a factor of 4 greater than your initial field. You can sort of go through and look for larger and larger Kx components. By the time you're at a Kx of 1.3, you need to get up to around 13 times the field here, and still that's not very sub-wavelength. By the time you're at, say, a Kx of 3.5, the field on this side, and this is already you're seeing some of the effects of finite absorption, finite loss. The field on this side is 10,000 times your initial source. So it's a pretty impractical situation. This is a slab that's one wavelength long, and the loss that was put in was 10 to the ninth, and you're seeing that even a loss that small, that impractically small, gives you it starts to affect your results. So we had to look at what parameters might be feasible. If you make thinner lenses, you get better, obviously, a better result. So this is the same result, Kx equals 3.5, but now we're lambda over 10, and we're back down to only needing a factor of 4 increase in the field on the far side. So, okay, we can do a thinner lens. Lambda over 10 is already a problem for us because our material, the spacing was lambda over 6. So there's no way we could achieve this without going to another design. So suppose we had another design, could we make a lambda over 10 lens? So then you start looking at how the deviations from the ideal condition affect things. And this is changing, this is just an example of changing the imaginary part. Sorry, the real part. A deviation in the real part. So we're changing the real part of mu, and we have some losses of one part in 1,000, 0.001. So there's two effects that happen. As you decrease, as you change, tune the real part away from minus 1, you're limiting your Kx. This is a transfer function. You're limiting your Kx values, so your sub-wavelength imaging is getting worse, and you introduce a resonance on the thing, which is a plasmon-type resonance that is going to affect your image. So there's two bad things that happen, and the end result, and we did a lot of parametric studies, which I don't need to. Go through. Lots of parametric studies end up with the conclusion that you need roughly one part in 1,000, no more than one part in 1,000 deviation in epsilon, and mu if you want an isotropic material. And something that's lambda over 10. At least with FR4, we're not going to reach that. So, and I'm not even sure with some of the better materials that we could reach that. Since then, John's been looking at other configurations that do better, and I think there is something practical that can be built. But the symmetric perfect lens, as first presented, is impractical for the materials that we use. Okay. So I think we concluded that it was just at the end if we used maybe a superconducting sample and some active tuning or something. And that was the conclusion, and we decided that it's best demonstrated in other configurations. And one of the best, I think, is to section the lens up and where you don't have to have those large fields building up. Now, the other thing that's something somewhat interesting that Marshall first came to us and wanted to discuss was that he said, if you have this perfect lens, and this has now, I think, been resolved by John and others, but it was interesting to him at the time. If you have this perfect lens, you have a source here, and suppose you have a singularity here. If you look at these image points, you expect to see just say you have a perfect point source, say a dipole source, it's singular. You would expect that this, by this reasoning, you would give you a singularity here and a singularity here, but either of these singularities don't satisfy Maxwell's equations. This one does, it has fields emanating in all directions, but these have fields coming in on one side and going out on the other. And that bothered him, and so he sort of scratched out a solution by Laplace transform to look at the time dependence. And I'll give you his conclusion. The conclusion was, yes, you can asymptotically reach this if you let t go to infinity. So it's sort of an unrealizable limit, but it satisfied him. There's a couple of poles that move off to infinity. So we decided to go ahead and look for the time dependence and go through and actually do the calculation. And it was also motivated because in finite difference time domain calculations, there's meshing issues that come into play. And we thought it would be nice to have an analytically based solution to compare with what comes out of these simulations. So this is what we did. This is the source distribution to, say, slits. And we're going to turn them on at t equals 0. So we have a step function here and then subsequent time dependence. So in Laplace, if you take a look at the Laplace transform of this is there's some function, and Fourier transform in the spatial coordinate. This is x, and you're going to propagate along z. So you have some function of kx, and then you have this pole here that comes from the source term. If you look at the transfer function on the other side of the lens at z equal 2d, for example, you have this form here where lambda is q over mu p, and q is your kz in the material, p is kz in free space, s equals I omega is a Laplace transform variable, and this thing has a sort of a nasty analytic structure that gives rise to this strange time dependence that we see. This denominator has lots of poles, essential singularities, branches. The branch cuts are due to p because the function is symmetric in q. So there's two ways of going about this. You could either integrate directly along in the Laplace transform. You can integrate along this axis, the imaginary s-axis. Or you can go through and deform the contour and add up the contributions from the branch cuts and all the poles. And so we've done both methods. Here's a picture of what the space looks like. Here's the two branch cuts, and here's the poles that are circled. As a function of parameters, as a function of time, these poles all move around and you have to track them. So Dave Schurig wrote a program that tracks all the poles and keeps the sum. And these are the results. What you're seeing here are the two slits, the initial source distribution, and here's the Fourier transform distribution for the steady state. This is what we'd expect to see. So as a function of time, we're seeing a transient transfer function, which multiplies this Fourier transfer function and gives you the image as a function of time. And so for very, very short times, it turns out just the near field passes through. It's another interesting result. This is 0.2 cycles, 0.2, yeah, 0.2 cycles. And you're seeing the image here, and the image is pretty good. And as you go a little bit further in time, the image gets better. And this is still on the order of 0.2. It's very, very short. So you have this transient where the transfer function looks pretty good. And then as time goes on, it gets worse. This initial perfect image starts to go away. And gets worse, more corrupted. We're still down around 0.204 at this point, cycles in. And then the behavior that you expect starts to happen. It gets very crummy and then starts to build up. And this is sort of a depiction of the amount of time that's spent. And takes about, this is equivalent to steady state here, and this is the final picture, the final image. And that takes about 50 to 100 cycles to develop. So the material has some, because of the dispersion and because it gets hung up in these surface resonances, it takes a while to form the image. And I think Rick's found some similar. Have you?
I don't know if I would follow.
Oh, you were a different problem where, okay, you'll probably talk about that one. So, actually, aside from this initial transient, nothing too unexpected happens with the time-dependent problem. But at least we have a solution with two methods that agrees. The direct integration agrees, and also this method of tracking the poles. Okay.
What
was the scale on the transient? 0.2 cycles. And up here, we're at 100 cycles. That's relative to the, if the source object is 1, then this image was 0.8. 0.8, 80%.
Steady state,
yeah. Steady state was less, I think. Steady state is about 0.4. So it's an interesting phenomena. Yeah. Extra. Yes. Yeah. It's an interesting little thing. So I just wanted to catch this one last topic because the other little bit of controversy is. Yes. Well, I. Yeah, these are the branch cuts here that you can see. And
usually you can identify we
gave up on that. we tried to. We talked with Marshall and That's true. You can identify those.
That's looking natural. But what are the others? I mean, why so many? Are they, like, you said something about modified?
Yeah, well, the surface platform in the hospital is basically black was
going
on.
Oh,
yeah, I mean, black.
It is definitely a painful problem. They tracked all of those poles, and as they hit the branch cuts, they pass on another sheet, and so we ended up having to track all poles on both sheets and keep track of the physical ones. Anyway, so this is just the last topic. There was some another bit of controversy raised as to whether a modulated beam could, if you could prove a modulated beam didn't negatively refract, if for some reason the group velocity didn't refract negatively. Right. So there's been a paper published in PhysRev Letters suggesting that you'd never have group negative refraction. That you can, yes, you can have phase refraction, but if you have any physically realizable wave, which would include some amount of modulation, then that wave would positively refract. And I'm going to go over why that conclusion was reached and why we think it's not the right conclusion. So here's the problem that was solved in that PRL. You come in with a wave that has, say, two frequency components. This is the picture that we like, and your two frequency components will have slightly different angles of refraction in the medium. So this is the picture. And you can work through and find the delta Q. So this is a modulated beam here. This is the ending result. This is a modulation term. And this modulation term is going to give you an interference pattern. And this, which is defined as a group index, is always greater than or equal to 1. So if you look at this term, you end up with an interference pattern that always appears to have right-handed refraction. So this is coming in direct incidence. Here's the interface. The dispersive properties of the medium, even though this is set to be near n equals minus 1, give you already sort of a beat pattern. This is the modulation fronts. And the modulation fronts change just because of the dispersive properties of the medium. Now you come in at an angle. If you look at the refraction of this interference pattern, you see that it looks positive. And they equated, in that paper, they equated this interference pattern with the group velocity. But where did they go wrong, or where do we think they went wrong? Well, they defined a group velocity as being d omega dq. So they have a definition of group velocity that depends on how your wave enters, even though your material is isotropic. The correct group velocity description should be the gradient of omega with respect to Q. And this is also pointed out in a recent preprint by Duncan Haldane on the Los Alamos server. He's got it in a footnote.